Welcome to the Hall of Blue Illumination, the podcast dedicated to M.A.R. Barker's legendary world of Tekumel.
Welcome to the Hall of Blue Illumination, the Tekumel podcast dedicated to the legendary world of M.A.R. Barker. Today is our 10th episode, I do believe, which is some kind of milestone or another, but probably not any more than your 9th or 11th episode. With me today are James Malaszewski.
Hello.
And Victor Raymond.
Hey there.
Now, there's some talk of practical advice for running a Tekumel game. What do you think, Victor?
Well, this is something of a carry-on from our previous discussions. And I was struck by what someone said that this came up in one of our previous talks, the idea that Tekumel is a setting which precedes the game. And that's distinct from D&D, where the game tends to precede the setting. I may be misremembering it, but
yeah, that's exactly right. That was the point that was made.
Yeah, and I think that creates some interesting dynamics for somebody who wants to pick that up and run it. And so often I hear people say, "Oh, it's so large. I can't get my arms around it. I don't know where to start, and I'm afraid of getting it wrong." Okay, we'll use that as kind of a starting point, because I think the setting can be somewhat daunting and intimidating. But there's some pretty straightforward ways of getting at this, and I want to encourage people to come up with their own approaches, but there's some really practical advice I think we can offer people about how to approach Tekumel to run it. And the first one, the first piece of advice, which we've talked about before, is make it your own Tekumel. Don't be afraid of diverging from history. If you're really that worried about it or you want to maintain the history, go ahead and set it in a time where there is no history and make it up as you go along. No one's going to tell you you're doing it wrong. But from a practical perspective, I think the scale issue is one that people let run away from them. And in talking with James about his two campaigns, I think one of the most important things you can do is decide on where you want to start your game. And it doesn't have to be in Chikala. It can be in any of a number of places. It just simply has to be someplace where you feel comfortable creating things on your own. James, your thoughts in this regard?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think that's absolutely true. The Socotis campaign, for example, the reason it was chosen is I wanted a place that had a vaguely similar political situation, or overall situation to Jakala, where you have a place on the edge of the empire where people could come from other places, particularly foreigners. You know, the traditional Fresh Off the Boat campaign. And so I believe you actually suggested Socotis, saying that it occupied a similar place in sort of the Eastern Empire, that people would come from Pachano and Salarvia and other sorts of places into the empire, and that you could do that. And I'd chosen on that basis. But you could just as easily run one, say, in Kirgar or Three Eel or someplace else on the edge. That was what I wanted. That's the reason I chose it. But each of the cities of Solyanu, or beyond it for that matter, has a kind of a flavor to it. And you have to think about what aspects of the setting you're most interested in playing with, at least initially, and find a place that suits that encourages that and highlights that. And I think that's, you know, a good way to start. You sort of zoom in, I guess, on that location. And I suppose you could do it not even in a city. There's no reason why it has to be set in a city. That seems to be a classic EPT tradition, but you could set it somewhere out, you know, in the not necessarily the wilderness, but in the countryside. And that isn't necessarily some large city, but sort of a town or a village or settlement or whatever, if that was what you were interested in emphasizing about Techno.
Mm-hmm. There's, I think, at least one recent account of someone who has been running a campaign set in Jammu and Kelelamo, which has, I'm sure, a completely different feel to it, because we're dealing with more feudal societies that have either, you know, echoes of the Engsvanyali deities or their own deities of the Northeast. And yet that's still Techamel. That's still it's still part of the world.
Yes, very much so.
And you could even, for example, in the case of the campaign that you have right now, you could set the campaign in not even a city or a land location at all. You could make the players part of an expedition to go explore, you know, pick a direction and see where it takes you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And give them a ship and off you go. And, you know, a campaign.
Ironically,
like
that's where we've ended up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there you are. Yeah, exactly. Well, who knows where you'll come out, right? But, I mean, in a campaign like that, you know, where you have a ship, which, by the way, is a trope that's been used in D&D games, but, you know, in the case of Techamel, you'll have, let's see now, Engsvanyali lost colonies, you'll have echoes of the Lords of the Latter Times, you'll have all sorts of things to draw on. And I think people sometimes shy away from that sort of thing because they think, oh my gosh, it's off the map. And we've talked a little bit about that before, too.
Yes.
Yeah. But I think that once you're comfortable with it, it's very tempting. But for the beginning referee, the beginning GM who wants to tackle Techamel, once you focused in on a place, I think the next piece of advice that I would probably want to offer is ask yourself, who's there? You know? And one of the nice things about this is that if you set it in the Five Empires in Solyanu and say, for example, a minor city, or a major city, you know, some locale, you're going to find that there are a whole range of people that you can easily devise if there is no one that you know of, you know, from the official records. And so that would include, for example, the priests and priestesses of the different temples. It would include the officials of the four palaces of the realms. It would include various practical people in the form of clanspeople offering services and goods and things and of that nature, as well as also probably some people who would be useful servants or providers of assistance. A quick list of people comes up with somewhere in the order of at least 20 to 50 easily devised NPCs. And you don't even have to have more than just a name for them, I think. I think the way to start is to have some sense of what's going on with those people, and then think about what sorts of adventures could be generated from that context. I mean,
absolutely. I mean, what you said about the name is interesting too, because I've always taken it upon myself to make sure that everyone has a name, or I try to, I don't always succeed. Just because that way it lends a sort of weight to any NPC encounter, because he's not just some, you know, faceless individual. He has a name and, by extension, you know, a clan and a place in the society. And that sort of helps to sort of, you know, paint the picture of what's going on. It's another way to sort of fill in, I guess, some of the color of the setting, and you get a sense of you know, what things are like there, and that's very, very helpful. I started with a fairly small list of NPCs because my focus initially was, you know, on a sort of inter-clan sort of matter, and so it was mostly just, you know, the player characters and a few clansmen and a handful of other people. But then it's a kind of, you know, a rock dropped in the water, I guess, and you have these sort of, you know, ripples that go out, and as the characters become involved with, you know, further and further aspects of the, you know, parts of the society, I added more. So now I've collected a very large number of NPCs, and that's another useful thing too, keeping track of all these people. It's very helpful, I find, because some person encountered at one point could very easily turn into someone more significant later on. And as I said, it lends weight and a little bit of depth to the campaign. For it's like, oh yes, I remember that guy. We ran into that fellow in the Palace of the Realm when we were researching wills or whatever, some records office person. Well, now here he is, and he's offering us to go look into something else. And it just makes it seem as if there's some there, which I find is particularly helpful in TechML.
And that's something that Professor Barker would do as well, is that we would run into people time and again, and they would end up having their own goals, their own initiative, their own sense of what was important, as well as also, competition with others. Very oftentimes you'd find people who wanted one thing and they would be opposed by somebody else who wanted something, completely different. And in that, I think it's important, particularly when setting up adventures on TechML, is that for everyone who has a particular goal, who would wish to be the protagonist of that story, there are going to be antagonists. There are going to be people with competing interests. And that's part of how TechML has depth to it, that rarely do you run across situations where it's a simple, well, let's go and do something, that oftentimes there are greater considerations at stake. And a little bit of thought in that regard makes a big difference, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have experienced it firsthand, so what you're saying is quite right.
Yes, and one way to get at this is that there is that chart in Empire of the Petal Throne, it's I think section 1110, that provides a, here is a, some idea of who's offering a mission and some idea of what the mission is. I think one of the things that could be done there is, in addition to providing who is the person providing the mission, who has the mission to undertake, you could also roll to see who is perhaps in opposition to it, or who has a tangential interest that intersects with that of the person who has the money who wants to hire you. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that only because of the fact that I think that while you can play TechML in a sort of D&D way, and don't get me wrong, there's a lot of fun to be had in doing that, at some point, the depth of the world is going to pick some of that up and say, wait a second, yes, you've gone off, you found all those Kytars, and you've, begun to live better. But at some point, that the world, that setting, is going to come back around and say, ah, and now what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So on a practical level, there's a lot of advice on the internet for how to start a campaign, obviously. Mm-hmm. Any search of this nature will reveal probably way too much information. However, mm-hmm. in this particular instance, I find that index cards go a long way to helping set up exactly the kinds of things that we've just discussed. Using index cards, I find, gets me away from the computer, which is often helpful in focusing on the matter at hand rather than doing all of the things that the computer has to offer. Mm-hmm. But it would be a simple matter for one to have a stack of index cards and make 3 to 5 non-player characters, 3 to 5 locations, 3 to 5 plots that are afoot, and maybe a couple of other categories. And just, I like to place them on the table and begin clustering the index cards with the concepts that resonate together.
Oh, absolutely.
And that way you don't have to have a very clear idea of exactly everything that's going to go on in a session. I think a lot of beginning game masters feel like they need to know exactly what's going to happen during a session, when the fact of the matter for me is just to play to find out what happens. I find that to be a pretty powerful phrase in alleviating any sort of anxiety one might have over what you think ought to have happened in a session.
Oh, yeah.
So, there's a certain amount of improvisation involved. Having the index cards in front of you is super helpful. And then writing either down on paper or however, or just holding in your mind, what is the opening scene? And I think that that's enough to start a Tecmo game. And James mentioned in a previous episode that the players come up with many interesting things that the GM did not come up with.
Oh, yeah.
So really just having big ears and taking a few notes when something interesting arises in play and allowing that to drive the direction of the narrative rather than having a need as a referee to have some authorial agenda or, you know, needing things to go a certain way. I think that produces undue anxiety.
Absolutely. And I would say that that is perhaps some of the best advice that I've heard so far, is to get away from the computer. Just, and have some notepaper handy for writing down those relationships, how things cluster, how things evolve. And in particular, there's two more things that I would put in there that would help in keeping a Tecmo campaign from running away with you. One of them is keeping really close track of time. And that is to say, use that calendar, you know, find out, you know, when people are, and keep track of how much time is spent on doing various things. And that's something Professor Barker did, and he did it very intentionally in order to ensure that people understood the passage of time in a game. So that's number one. And then number two, take some notes after each session. You know, they don't have to be extensive, but just keep track of how things evolved over the course of the game, and then use that again to see how things develop for the next session.
I would like to offer something that I've started doing in my home game, which is the Strange game, not an EPT game or Tecmo game, but it could very well become a Tecmo game for a time, if that's where it leads. But I have acquired a very beautiful journal that is purple and swirling pink and has latches and looks very much like an artifact of a fantasy world. And I offered that to the players. And then during the game, one of the players volunteers, and this player changes from game to game, to just keep track of what happens in the game in the journal. And that has been great fun, both for the person who is doing the writing, but also at the beginning of the next session, that person will read what they wrote the previous week as a reminder of what has happened in the campaign, and also a way to orient the action for what is to happen in the current session. So in addition to taking my own notes, I find that hearing things from the player's perspective is very refreshing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I can see that. I can certainly see that.
Well, we probably
everyone has a different voice too. Sorry, I didn't mean to stomp over you. Everyone writes in from their character's perspective, mm-hmm. and has a different narrative way of going about it. One of my players drew everything in pictographs, and it told its own perfectly lucid story. That was pretty entertaining.
I could see where that would be a lot of fun. Well, I think, you know, there's probably some more structure that we could give to this in terms of advice on how to run a game, but I just keep coming back to this as something that I would love to hear about the experiences that people have running their own Tecmo campaigns and what they come up with, because I think that by sharing those ideas is how we discover, you know, a lot more about what makes Tecmo special. So, you know, if you're listening to this, I would encourage you to let us all know here at the Hall of Blue Illumination what you have found that works for you and what makes a good campaign last.
Let's look at the pronunciation of the program sound.
Here we are to speak as properly as we earth beings can. The names of the five Thimekluyal of the gods of stability. Victor, who is the first?
Yeah. The first is Draw. This one's easy. Draw the Emperor.
Yes. Cohort of Nala, singer of the hymns of the gods.
Yes, and it's an interesting bit of theology here. If Lord Nala wants the universe to reach an ending moment of perfection, this perfect stasis of stability, then all of Dra's attention is drawn to that. Everything else is but illusion. The momentary changes of life are, from Dra's perspective, unimportant in the light of Lord Nala's ultimate perfection.
That would keep them detached from, how shall I say, from the text, interest in the ephemeral things of existence.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Lord Dra does not have any temples per se, except as annexes to the temple of Nala. Well, I should be careful. I'm sure that there might be a monastery or two here or there, or perhaps special shrines that have been erected in his honor. But the priesthood of Dra is not terribly interested in the here and now.
It's almost as if the priests of Nala create a space for the worshippers of Dra to exist, because it seems unlikely mm-hmm. that they would bother to build anything on their own.
Yep, that's a fine sense of it.
Well, we follow Dra the Uncaring with Chegara, the hero king, swordsman of glory, victorious lord, cohort of Karakhan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chegara is interesting because he's not just the expression of war in the as a noble activity, but war in the service of society. And so Chegara is very much part of the fabric of keeping the empire strong. Its temples and priesthood there are all very much devoted to that. Yeah. The war gods, as they are sometimes called, the Karakhan, Chegara, Vimukla, and this is terrible. I'm blanking for a moment.
Chitang,
that's right. Chitang, they have a great deal more in common with one another as being militarily oriented. And so they form often their own faction. They do have doctrinal differences which split them apart from time to time, or even political differences, as for example, in the 2356-57 onwards, you have Princess Selme being the favored candidate of the war gods of stability, and then Prince Mirasia being the favored candidate for the war gods of change.
I personally am a Mirasia fan, and I don't know why. But I don't need to know why.
Mm, it's an interesting thing. Princess Selme, always a very bluff, very hearty, very much a man of action. In the interactions that my characters had with Selme, he was always he embodied a certain kind of Soyani noble ideal, which was to say, he said what he meant, he did what he was supposed to, and he acted in all ways as nobly as possible. And yet, for all of that, there's always the suggestion, there's always that sense that sometimes came out that Selme was a little too much that. There wasn't an awful lot of depth to the man.
That's certainly how he's portrayed in the novels.
Yeah, and truth be told, in the game situations that we encountered him in on Thursday nights, that was certainly the sense that we got of it. The good thing about Mirasia was the fact that he was very very clear about what he wanted and what he didn't want, and you acted towards him accordingly.
You mean Selme?
Eselme, I'm sorry, that's right, Eselme. Mircea, on the other hand, was a fellow who was very smart and very noble, and you know, and eventually becomes emperor. You know, there you are. But you know, in all of his dealings, there was greater depth, a certain amount of deeper consideration, intellectual awareness. I'm not saying that, you know, he was a plotter or a schemer in that sense, but he was shrewd and subtle in a way that Eselme never was. And now we veered away from language to talk about politics.
Oh. No, well, it's all related, you know. This is the Techml podcast, so as long as it's Techml, it's fair game. But anyway, that brings us to Katengku, the many-eyed, the knower of all, master of scrolls, cohort of Thumis.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any additional commentary for Katengku?
Well, again, I mean, the cohorts are often the more socially oriented or realized aspects of the god's nature themselves. And so Katengku is interesting because Lord Thumis is about wisdom. Wisdom, knowledge.
As an learning. Abstract principle.
Right. And Katengku is saying, yeah, but what are you going to do with it?
I was looking over the source book last night, as I am wont to do on occasion, and this notion of the cohorts being the sphere of the deity applied, I thought, was a good way to conceive of it.
Yeah, very much so. That's exactly what's going on here. Lord Shigata, for example, is a lord of war, but he's also about military engineering, about architecture, about the conduct of battle and how things are done and the rituals to be observed. I mean, not that Karakhan is not, but, you know, this is where Chagata really gets into it. Is similar, Katengku is a god of scribes and apothecaries and persons who are responsible for different ways of knowing things, you know, astronomers, astrologers, alchemists, and many others.
So the next cohort is Dilinala. She is the lovely maiden of the Emerald Crown, aid of lovers, solace to the weary, handmaiden of Avanthe, and daughter of Nala. Okay, Emerald Crown? What, doesn't that cross over?
Yeah, that's suggestive, isn't it?
Yeah.
These are the terms that were given down from the Engsvanyali to the Second Imperium and how they are understood in Soyanu today. And the thing about it is that this is language that suggests a more complex past that may not be as so neat and simple as presented by Pivar's current depiction.
Yeah, it's like the classification is a reduction of the complexity of the reality of the gods.
Mm-hmm. That's a very, very, very important thing to know about Techno.
Well, when we get back, or not when we get back, but when we introduce the Book of Ebon Bindings, then the introductory essay...
Say not that name.
Will the introductory essay will be quite informative with regard to this topic.
Yes, Semel Kiren Hiket Kolel has much to say on the subject of how this should be approached with caution.
Was that an individual you encountered as an NPC or simply someone who was offstage as an author?
I believe we interacted a few times with Semel, the cardinal, high priest of Temple of Kesaro, Kiren Hiket Kolel.
Yes.
And the thing about it is that as a person, actually someone who we interacted with more was one of the people who was thanked at the beginning of the Book of Ebon Bindings for her assistance in its compilation and presentation. And that is the lady Kelisu Hidiridame.
I like everything about that. That is my feedback. James has written a bit about the next one, should we want to proceed there. In the excellent traveling volume, there are Demons of Belkhanu and Kon. Kon, the Ancient One of Pleasures, guardian of the gates of hell against those who would come forth. Cohort of Belkhanu.
Now, how do you pronounce a Q?
I could make up an answer at this point, but I hesitate. We have always, in my recollection, we have always heard it as Kon.
Okay.
Kon.
Well, yeah, it's supposed to be a K that's pronounced in the back of the throat, for whatever that
right.
means.
That's what I was trying to do.
Kon.
Yeah.
Well, think of a K. Normally in North American English, if you were to hear a K sound, K, you know, if you'll notice, that sound is usually towards the front and the upper part of the palate, you know, okay, right? And what I'm suggesting is that you consciously move that back to the back of the mouth, back, you know, towards the throat, and you say Kon. So your moment of saying of making the enunciation is happening further back in the mouth. So that's Kon.
You feel it in your body differently too, especially since it's followed by an O. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it's down, like it originates in the chest and comes out, as opposed to a word like camera, which is all very in the head voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's I think that's a good way of thinking and describing it. The thing about Kon as a cohort is that Belkhanu is both a god of the cycle of life and death and the transmigration of souls, but also about the greater myriad planes through which the universe is expressed. And so Kon is that aspect of the deity, that the cohort of the deity, acting in ways to protect and to guide those, both the souls, but also those who would journey beyond.
That explains the guardian of the gates of hell against those who would come forth.
Yeah, and I think one of the aspects of this that's important to keep in mind here is that we are also only getting the very surface level description of each one of these gods when, if we were to refer back to, say, Mithlamyal, we would discover that all of the gods, except for Dra, have multiple aspects, which represent multiple ways in which they are represented and worshipped and understood.
Well, there is certainly no shortage of material with regard to the gods that we can explore in further episodes.
Right. So
I look forward to the opportunity. The philosophical implications of this mythology are very interesting to me.
Yes. I think that when we go through and we do the other five cohorts, that now that I remember Shetang, we will be able to explore these things in more detail.
Thank you for listening to the Hall of Blue Illumination. You can email us your questions, queries, and other topics at citizen@techmlpodcast.com. You can also find TechML Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, take care and have fun playing in the world of Tech ML.